Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The House is back in Washington with Speaker Mike Johnson apparently determined to pass an aid bill for Ukraine and other American allies around the world, but with a motion to boot him from leadership also hanging over his head. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We are joined today by my colleagues, editorial board member Kate Batchelder-Odell and columnist Kim Strassel. After what we trust was a relaxing and productive congressional recess, the House is back in D.C. on Tuesday, and the betting seems to be that some kind of Ukraine package will probably get through the House somehow. But will it be able to make it through the Rules Committee and then pass with just a majority vote? Will it have to be taken up on a suspension of the rules, which requires two-thirds approval? And what will the bill look like? That all remains to be seen. Meantime, the bill passed by the Senate, which includes about $60 billion for Ukraine, is bottled up in the House, but 190 Democrats and one Republican so far have signed a discharge petition, and if that reaches a majority, it could force a vote on that package. Kate, what's your assessment of the state of play in the House, and how do you think the Speaker is considering these trade-offs and the kind of legislation that he seems to be floating?
Well, before we get into what's going on the House, I do think it's important to frame a little bit what's going on in Ukraine, because I think it's really influencing what's happening in the House. The Ukrainians are in a precarious position right now. They are holding very fragile lines against the Russians, and the Russian military is making small, about 300 square kilometers by some estimates, progress on the front, and it's coming at a very high cost. They're still taking very large infantry losses. However, there's a lot of evidence that Russia is reconstituting, that they are digging deeper into their stocks of artillery, that they are leaning on North Korea and Iran for more weapons, and that also Russia is quite serious about mounting a spring offensive later this spring or into the summer. And so Ukraine right now does not have what it needs to resist that offensive. And this is, I think, focusing the minds in Washington, because the options are you help Ukraine hang on, or you own what comes next, which unfortunately could still be a loss for the Ukrainians that is not favorable to the United States. So I think what's going on in the House now is that you have that reality starting to set in, because right now, if the House declines to support further Ukraine aid, President Biden will blame Republicans all the way to November as a political matter for cutting off Ukraine, that he wanted to help our allies, that it was the isolationist Republicans who wouldn't allow him to do so. And I think that would just be an enormous mistake on Republicans' part. Because it wasn't Republicans who decided to give Ukraine only a handful of long-range missiles years into the war. It was the Biden administration that did that foot-dragging. They also spent months debating what kind of tanks that we should give Ukraine. The president's record on Ukraine is weak. And so I think that is part of what's influencing now. You have House Republicans starting to get serious about getting aid to Ukraine through. And what you're going to see here, I think it's still being organized behind the scene. I think you're going to get scenes, but I think you're going to see some package that tries to move mostly lethal assistance to form other types of assistance that maybe go to Ukraine's budget as a loan, and then tries to attach some Republican policy victories. We can talk a little bit more about the LNG ban that Republicans are trying to overturn, and also possibly try to pay for some of the aid by seizing Russian foreign assets. So that's the contours of, I think, the larger stakes and how the bill's shaping up in the House.
To start with the reality on the ground, Kate mentioned the figure of about 300 square kilometers of territory retaken. One place that is using that number is the Institute for the Study of War. This is from an April 2 assessment of the Russian offensive. It says between January 1 and April 1, 2024, Russian forces have seized approximately 305 square kilometers. ISW continues to assess that material shortages are forcing Ukraine to conserve ammunition and prioritize limited resources to critical sectors of the front. However, increasing the risk of a Russian breakthrough in other less well-provisioned sectors and making the front line overall more fragile than the current relatively slow rate of Russian advances makes it appear. And Kim, I think that may be part of it. Precisely what Kate is saying is that the reality is sinking in Washington that this could move, and this could move relatively quickly. You could have a Russian breakthrough. Notably also on April 2nd, President Vladimir Zelensky signed a law lowering the age for Ukraine's military mobilization from 27 to 25. And notable in this debate is President Trump's role. He's the presumptive Republican presidential nominee at this point. And at least to my eye, I haven't seen him weigh in and say this aid to Ukraine is a terrible mistake, as you could imagine him doing in some sort of dashed off Truth Social post. And he has said that he wants to end the war. He has said that within 24 hours, he will get some negotiation to do so. The Washington Post over the weekend had some reporting, said that Trump's proposal consists of pushing Ukraine to cede Crimea and the Donbas border region to Russia, according to people who discussed it with Trump or his advisors and spoke on the condition of anonymity. So we don't know exactly. He hasn't rolled out a precise policy platform. But it seems to me, if you are a Republican in the House, anything that you can do to help Ukraine hold on and reverse those Russian gains, if possible, between now and when you hope that President Trump is going to take office, would only strengthen President Trump's hand and Ukraine's hand if President Trump thinks this is going to go to some kind of negotiation.
There certainly is a moment happening in Washington. I would argue that it's overdue, but it finally came about because Congress was able belatedly to get done with its funding problem for 2024. And Kate laid out very well the difficulties that the Ukrainian side is facing and the huge risks that would come if we do not act and move. But I think it's also important to recognize, just in terms of the ground, that folks in Washington also understand that on the flip side, there's potentially an opportunity as well. It's both sides of the same coin, in that Russia has also had a rough couple of years. If you go back to December, our intelligence agencies estimated that they had lost 315,000 troops so far, and it's now a two-year engagement. Last year, Russia itself had to raise its conscription age to 30 from 27 to try to replace those big losses. There was a recent estimate that they have lost about $55 billion worth of equipment, which, to put in context, is half of this year's defense budget for Russia. So, I mean, that's an extraordinary number. They have more wherewithal, especially because they've had ongoing industrial and commercial support from backers like China. And so if we've already invested what we have in this, that is the stakes that we're talking about, is are we going to just allow this to falter into attrition, or are we going to seize this moment? And that gets to Donald Trump. I think that already some people have made the argument to him that if he really is serious about his argument that if he were president, he could solve this in a short period of time, get everyone at the negotiating table. If that's the case, his hand is going to be infinitely more strengthened to do that. If Ukraine is back on the offense and has made some gains before the election. So it's been very notable that Trump has not come out to oppose the Repo Act, which is what Mike Johnson is now putting forward. This notion of loans and this notion, too, of seizing some of Russia's sovereign assets to help pay for some of this. He's giving people a window. And I think that that's also been aided by a number of pro-Ukrainian Russians who've continued to have good ties with Donald Trump, who have been calling him and making the case that this needs to get through. So you definitely feel something has shifted and that there is a possibility. The risk on the other side is that those who oppose this aid have been digging in even further. And I think the risk not just that they threaten Mike Johnson and his speakership over it, but that they somehow convince Donald Trump to come out and also put his finger on the scale here, which could make an already difficult situation harder.
Hang tight. We'll be right back in a moment.
The Claude 3 model family from Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. With models at every point on the price-performance curve, you no longer have to make trade-offs between intelligence, speed, and cost. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Haiku is the fastest and lowest cost model on the market, perfectly designed for high volume, high speed use cases. Join the thousands of enterprises who trust Anthropic to keep them at the frontier. Visit anthropic.com/Claude today.
Welcome back. What about President Biden's role in all of this? Where is his leadership, both in terms of getting the public on board with this idea, building public pressure to not abandon an ally like Ukraine, as well as other allies around the world, including Israel and Taiwan? And where is his effort to convince some of these Republicans in the House to go along, convince enough Democrats in the House to go along to get this over the finish line, especially if it needs that two-thirds hurdle under a suspension of the rules? And Kate, to that point, if Republicans put some things in this bill as policy that they want, that they think will rally more Republican members to this legislation, something overruling that pause the Biden administration has put in place on liquefied natural gas facilities, export facilities, do you think that President Biden would sign that if that legislation got to his desk?
Well, the details on that have been evolving, and there is some concern that the details of the specific LNG pause that is under discussion would be quite limited and not have the large effect on new projects that its proponents of overturning the ban would want. So we'll have to see the details on that, because if it is a fig leaf that Biden can sign, that's less of a victory for Republicans. But I do think that President Biden, first of all, has an obligation to make the public case for the Ukraine and Israel and Taiwan money that he's seeking, and that he has struggled to do that. However, at the State of the Union, he framed what's going on in the world as an inflection point on par with the late 1930s. That's a pretty heavy historical analogy. And so then to basically be unwilling to convince Democrats to vote for the bill, or to go around what the climate lobby wants in an election year in an LNG ban, I think would show some political cynicism on the president's part if he declined to really urge his colleagues to vote for the bill. So I do think you need more of a role of persuasion from the president. And there has been this public attitude as though Mike Johnson is the commander in chief, and he's not. That said, I think Johnson is smart to try to come up with something that can get as much of his conference as possible. The high watermark for Republicans opposing Ukraine aid is about 100, roughly half the conference. But that vote was a while ago, and there's reason to think that it was venting accumulated frustrations that Republicans have. The president's dithering in particular weapon types, and the lack of a larger strategy or thinking that the president really hasn't articulated. So I do think there is a possibility that more Republicans are persuadable on a Ukraine package that does address some of those issues, that gets them a discrete policy victory on energy, where Republicans tend to be in pretty broad agreement, one area of policy where there isn't much disagreement. So I think that could help Johnson get much closer to more than half of his conference, which would be important for him if he would like to stay in power. The more Republicans that he can get on board with this, the stronger the vote is, and the more likely I think he is to survive. But I think it makes him look like a leader, which is what the party wants, to be trying to move this package at all, to be saying out there, as Johnson did, we will do our job. I think that is a good bend for him to be taking to survive the rest of the year, no matter these critics that are threatening his hold on power.
The LNG pause is an interesting case, though, because, Kim, my read of that is that President Biden was pushed into doing that because he is trying to make sure that the climate left is excited and ready to go out and vote to reelect Joe Biden in November. But I think it's bad policy from an economic standpoint. We should want these jobs in the United States, drilling for natural gas here. From a climate standpoint, natural gas, if it can displace coal and other sorts of fuels, it can help actually lower emissions. That's how the U.S. over the last several years has drastically cut its emissions. And from a national security standpoint, we had lots of Europe worried about cold winters in the past couple of years after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And why should the U.S. not be sending our natural gas resources over to those allies in Europe to keep them warm? I think that it's good policy to continue this. So frankly, I wonder if from a political standpoint, Joe Biden would maybe benefit from losing this battle with Republicans, and he can sign the bill and say to the climate left, look, I tried, but we needed to get this aid to our allies in Ukraine and Israel and Taiwan. And then he doesn't have to go into the election weighed down by the bad policy and the bad politics of this LNG pause.
Yeah, of course he would. And by the way, this has been something that Republicans really need to amp up, which is the national security aspects of this. It's not just about keeping our allies warm, but of course, the reason that they have needed that additional LNG that we have helped to provide is because Vladimir Putin has threatened to cut off and, in fact, indeed has slowed deliveries to Western Europe. And that only makes Western Europe even more susceptible to his demands, more reluctant to really go after him and his terrible policies because they're held hostage to their energy problems. So this has been a vital aspect of the larger Ukraine war effort. And it makes zero sense for the administration to be coming to Congress and saying we need to do more for Ukraine, which we absolutely do, while simultaneously supporting an LNG export ban that is so detrimental to our allies that are also supporting and helping Ukraine as well, too. All for a climate objective, which is unrealistic. I mean, let me also point that out. This isn't going to make one bit of difference to global warming. It is a completely token move. And that's the problem. As with so much that's been going on in this White House, their only interest at the moment, it would seem, leading up to the election, is about re-engaging different portions of its base, its activist base. And there are a lot in the climate lobby that remain unhappy with the president because, for instance, he green-lighted the Willow drilling project in Alaska. He hasn't done enough here or there. You know, they wanted a complete end to fossil fuels, as unrealistic and silly as that is. So this is catnip to his climate crowd. It's undermining his own goals in Ukraine. But it's remarkable to me that he is actually willing, it would seem. Is he really going to refuse to sign a bill that has an LNG export provision in it? That also has the Ukraine funding he wants. I mean, that would be remarkable. And it's why Republicans should feel very confident about putting this in and getting that victory.
Hang tight. We'll be right back after one more break.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Assuming that Mike Johnson can get a bill with aid to Ukraine over the finish line, the question then is what comes next? Because before the House went into recess, Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene announced that she had filed a motion to vacate the chair. This was the motion that dethroned Speaker Kevin McCarthy, led to nearly a month of wrangling with Republicans, trying to find a speaker, failing to find a speaker, and then finally settling on Mike Johnson. And now it looks like she's gearing up for another divisive speaker fight. Let's listen to Speaker Johnson responding to this motion last week on Fox News.
All of my other Republican colleagues recognize this is a distraction from our mission. Again, the mission is to save the Republic. And the only way we can do that is if we grow the House majority, win the Senate, and win the White House. So we don't need any dissension right now. Look, Marjorie Taylor Greene filed the motion. It's not a privileged motion, so it doesn't move automatically. It's just hanging there. And she's frustrated. She and I exchanged text messages even today. We're going to talk early next week. Marjorie's a friend. She's very frustrated about, for example, the last appropriations bills. Guess what? So am I. As we discussed, Trey, these are not the perfect pieces of legislation that you and I and Marjorie would draft if we had the ability to do it differently. But with the smallest margin in U.S. history, we're sometimes going to get legislation that we don't like.
To underline the point about the narrowness of Speaker Johnson's margin at the moment, Republicans have a two-seat advantage in the House. It's 218 to 213 Democrats. But Congressman Mike Gallagher is about to leave the House, so that would bring it down to a one-seat majority. And Kate, I still am not sure if this is a real threat by Marjorie Taylor Greene or if she is just trying to make some more headlines. And it is notable that, as Speaker Johnson said, as far as I can tell, no other Republican has publicly signed up for this yet.
Yes, and I would suggest it being a threat and a stunt is not mutually exclusive. And to some extent, it's probably both. I do think that the dynamics are fundamentally different than they were when Republicans defenestrated Kevin McCarthy, and that those favor Mike Johnson, and that he is very hard to portray in the same way McCarthy was derided, that he doesn't have members who have personal grievances against him the way that Matt Gaetz did against Kevin McCarthy, for instance. And it also, you know, Republicans, I think some of them at least, may have learned something from the several weeks of chaos that followed having no speaker, the struggle to come up with one, and maybe are less enthused about the idea of doing that here in April as they cruise towards a November election. So you have a lot of options, ways that it could go, but my own modest prediction is that the motion doesn't move even if the Ukraine money passes. And that's because I think there are enough Republicans who understand that even if they're not happy with some of the ways the war in Ukraine has gone or what Biden has done, cutting off Ukraine and owning the consequences is not what they want. And also that they will not benefit in November from another 4 weeks of circular firing squad, and that Mike Johnson is simply hard to portray as a rhino sellout only weeks after you've promoted him from being a conservative backbencher to Speaker of the House. So all of that, I think right now, things could change. But I think right now it favors that motion failing. My last word on this would be that if Mike Johnson simply does whatever Marjorie Greene wants and doesn't do anything to offend her, then she's effectively the Speaker of the House. And I think, if anything, Johnson will command even more respect from his members by deciding that some projects the House needs to do, that he needs to govern, that he's obliged to govern, and that he will own the consequences if he doesn't pass the Ukraine bill. So again, I think it's a show of leadership on his part, and he deserves credit for it, and that ultimately conferences and voters tend to reward that quality.
Kim, what's your read of the dynamics here? One other thing that I would add is that Marjorie Taylor Greene is not backing down. On Tuesday, she released a Dear Colleague letter to the Republican conference, doubling down, or maybe I should say quintupling down. It's several pages long. Here is one of the most heated portions of it. She writes, "Mike Johnson worked with Chuck Schumer rather than with us and gave Joe Biden and the Democrats everything they wanted, no different from how a Speaker Hakeem Jeffries would have done. Speaker Johnson fully funded Special Counsel Jack Smith's witch hunt and 91 indictments against President Trump, our Republican presidential nominee. If convicted, this would be a death sentence for President Trump. A death sentence for President Trump is precisely what the Democrats want." And Kim, as is often the case with this faction of the party, what I don't see here is any real plan that would make any real difference. If House Republicans tried to pass some kind of budget that defunded Special Counsel Jack Smith, that would go to President Biden's desk and would be promptly vetoed. And it actually wouldn't even get there because it wouldn't get through Chuck Schumer's Senate. And I guess the point that I'm trying to make is there is all sorts of anger in the Republican conference, including from Marjorie Taylor Greene, but it's not limited to her. And what is lacking is any sort of sketch of how to get from point A, where they are, to point Z, where they want to be, in a divided government where they only control one chamber of the House by two votes.
I read that entire letter that Marjorie Taylor Greene sent out. And the thing that struck me about it is how easily it could have been a list of particulars not describing Speaker Johnson, but describing the fractious wing of the party that she ascribes to, which is very much to blame for some of the complaints that she has in there. I mean, for instance, she spent pages in the article describing her complaints about the recent funding bill that went through. By the way, I know that nobody was particularly happy with it. $1.2 trillion that did the major pieces of the government at the very end. And she had a bunch of complaints that, well, up until Kevin McCarthy was dethroned, we had passed 7 appropriations bills. There were 5 to go, but Mike Johnson didn't make those happen. Well, why didn't those happen? The reason they didn't happen, and they didn't go to the Senate, and that there weren't conferences with the Senate, and that this didn't happen in a regular order kind of way, which is what she wants, is that large factions of the Republican Party on the right said, if we can't have everything we want in these bills, including a whole lot of those extreme policy writers, well, I should say extreme to Democrats, those policy writers, which Joe Biden would have vetoed without blinking an eye, then we're not going to go through with this process. Okay, well, that's what ends up happening. And to sort of go back and suggest that this is now all on Mike Johnson because he can't suddenly magically make all the children get along with each other is just remarkable. And I think that's why people have not signed on to this letter. They understand the dysfunction that is going on. I do worry about this letter, though, in this regard. I think it was planned very carefully. I think she hinted at her warning before they went on break. She let that bubble and brew. And then she dropped this letter when she came back. And the key element of that letter was essentially a threat saying, if you really want to make everybody angry, go ahead and move on that Ukraine bill. So this letter was very carefully designed to try to put pressure on Johnson to back away from that. I totally agree with Kate that that would be detrimental to him and to the caucus. So she's getting a lot of attention, but hopefully the Republican Party has the ability in the House to see through the theatrics and focus on the prize.
Thank you, Kim and Kate. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button, and we'll be back tomorrow with another edition of Potomac Watch.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.